Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley. And our guest today, we're talking about a rather serious subject today. And our guest is Shatima Threadcraft. And she is an associate professor of gender and sexuality studies at Vanderbilt University and the author of Intimate Justice, The Black Female Body and the Body Politic from Oxford University Press in 2016. And her new book is The Labors of Resurrection, Black Women, Necromancy, and Morrisonian Democracy. And I'm not sure if I even pronounced that word correctly, but welcome to Writers' Voices, Shatima.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to join you.
Let's just start with the title of your book and what it means and how do we pronounce that word?
Yeah. Now, I'm sure your pronunciation is fine. I'm sure there's several. I say necromancy, but and that is the sort of the art of magic concerning the dead. So conjuring the spirits of the dead for the voices of the dead for the purposes of changing the present.
Okay. Is this a word that other people know and I'm just the only one who never heard of it before?
I mean, I think in fantasy and sci-fi, if you're, I think, you know, witchcraft, if you're into those kinds of things, but otherwise, probably no reason to know it.
So what is this book really talking about?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So this is a book about Black femicide, so the murder of Black women because they are Black women, or the murder of Black women because they are women, sort of facilitated by structural racism, including housing insecurity, inadequate safety provision, and medical neglect. And it highlights how these murders often take place in private, that is outside, away from view, and the problems that that causes for political organizing. It's also a book about Black women, the Black women and the Black feminists who are organizing to stop the murder of Black women, and relatedly, sort of the under-recognized forms of political action in response to those murders. And then I think finally, I'll say it's about the struggle that the families wage and deceased Black women themselves, the struggle that they face to enter the record as someone who was murdered and to enter the record in the right way, right? And and that would be against forms of true crime that are very salacious about the ways in which they are murdered. So the struggle to be entered into the record in humanizing way.
Okay, so there's a lot going on here.
Yeah, there is
a lot going on, and it's written from a fairly academic sort of perspective.
I think so. Yeah, there. So I think that the book, if I thought about it for who can read the book, I think if you are a person who is interested in the problem of femicide and the ways in which activists have countered it, you can read chapters 1 and 2 and you can kind of be done. You know, if you're a person who's interested in the historical forms of organizing, that is like Black women who have organized around it in the past, you can read chapters sort of 4 through 7 and be done. If you're a Toni Morrison, as my editor says, you know, if you're a Toni Morrison completist and you want to know everything about Toni Morrison, you can kind of read chapter 8. If you are interested in Black political thought and thinkers like W.E.B. Du Bois, you can read chapters 3 and chapter 8. So I feel like different people can come to this for different reasons. And, you know, while I would love everyone to read all of it, I understand the time that people have and I know how I have to read books. So you can go to it for what you need.
Okay. Now, speaking of time, how long did you work on this book?
Ooh, man, about 10 years.
Oh, my gosh. And what drew you to this subject to want to devote so much time and energy to it?
Yeah, thank you. So I think it was, I talk about not in the book, but in another piece I wrote, I talk about a friend who during the sort of first wave of Black Lives Matter protests in 2015, we were sitting in her car and she turned to me and she said, you know, that statistic where a Black man is killed by a police or security guard or vigilante every 28 hours, but did you know that a Black woman is killed by an intimate partner every 21 hours? And when she told me that, I was really very shocked. And from then, I kind of started investigating. And at the time, I was working with a group of scholars and had been asked to write about Black politics after Baltimore, after Ferguson. And so when I went to this workshop and we all had to turn in articles for it, I ended up writing a paper about sort of Black Lives Matter, sort of political organizing around the public murders of Black men, and then this issue of private violence. And from there, that article kind of started me to thinking about how I would put it into it.
Okay, so let's start with that, with this the concept of kind of the very public public response to very public murders of primarily men.
Yes.
And going back to, you know, talking about lynching and in you know, previous times and killing by police or, you know, we all know these, we've heard these stories and they do invoke a lot of sympathy and a lot of outrage. Why do you think that same level of sympathy and outrage isn't there for the deaths of Black women?
I think this is an excellent question and really the question, right? So there are a lot of factors here. So one, because they occur in private, people are less likely to know about them, right? Two, because they are women generally, and I think Black women too, are like much more likely to be killed by an intimate partner, right? And that sort of complicates the, you know, our ability to have sympathy for what's going on because we think, well, that's a relationship that's not really any of my business versus I think a very easy understanding of a conflict over state violence, right?
Right.
And then I think in the book, I make the argument that there's a long history of political organizing around spectacular death, right? And so the seeing, right? So the ability to physically see it is connected to the ability to sort of conceptually see it and understand it. And then there is part of the story that I'm trying to tell is about how the media isn't talking about it, right? So if you weren't there to witness it, there are other forms of witnessing that can take place via storytelling, via the media. And the scholars have mapped how much less attention even Black women who are killed by the police get than Black men killed by the police, right? So that we have, I mean, any feminist scholar, I think, will tell you, you know, white women, you know, women of Asian descent, et cetera, the struggle to get what they've done recognized and into the record is a long-standing one, right? And part of this, you know, there are people, including Aisha Reynolds Tyler, who studies and has, who's a data scientist who has critiqued the missing persons records keeping of the Chicago Police Department, right? So family members say that their loved one is missing and they won't take a police report. Or the Chicago PD reports that, you know, the case is closed, nothing criminal in nature, and the person was deceased and murdered, right? So
Wow. So
there's all kinds of struggles around knowledge, right? If we can't see it, if it's not recorded, right? The ways in which we make things known and make them to have social meaning, all of these things are going on at every level for us not to react.
You make a point, and which I hadn't really thought about, but even the women who are killed by the state, you know, police or in prison stuff, it's often in their homes or kind of outside the public view. And I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the names, but say the names of some of the of the ones recently.
Tatiana Jefferson, Charlene Lyles, and others. Yes, that is the case that. It is the case that, you know, just like, so part of what femicide scholars want to bring attention to is the fact that for all women, the murders of women take p- place in different places and are committed by different people than the murders of men. So men are not, Catherine D'Ignazio at MIT, who works in the data and feminism lab, says that men are not typically killed in their homes, and they're not killed in brutal and sexualized ways, right? So that homicide and femicide are sort of very different things, right? So that when a man is killed and when a woman is killed, it often sort of looks different.
The one I was thinking about was Breonna Taylor.
Yes, I'm sorry. So
yeah,
I got it. I lost my train of thought for a minute, but thank you for bringing me back. So that tracks to, that would include the ways in which women are killed by the police.
Yeah.
Right. So often Black women are killed in their homes, right? Because of, again, even when it's state violence, it's connected to romantic and intimate relationships. So Breonna Taylor was killed because the police were looking for her former partner, right? Yeah. So it's still, even though it is the police, right, it is still about this association with our sexual and intimate lives, right? So it's either police coming into the home during a mental health crisis being called, coming into the home during an intimate partner violence episode, or because the police are sort of looking for a partner, right? And so it then tracks with this forms of state violence kind of mirror the intimate partner violence, where the home is the dangerous place for women.
Yeah. Now, how do you tie this in with what you're writing about Toni Morrison and
you know, yeah, that's
Dubois
a great question.
And
yeah. So that's good. I do wonder sometimes how I did it. But I think that your point about lynching is, I think, the way a long way of talking about it. So one of the things that I noticed as I began to work on this issue of private violence against women, I noted the fact that many, many people compared, right, made an analogy between police violence and lynching. And, you know, this happened in the first wave of Black Lives Matter protests, but really increased with the murder of George Floyd. That is, many people said that he was lynched, right? And so what I wanted, I then went back to, so I wanted to talk about or think and research how lynching had come to have its symbolic significance in our understanding of racial oppression. So lynching sort of can stand in for, right? So it can serve as like a metonym for racial oppression sometimes, right? It's like the master form of kind of like racial oppression in a lot of ways. So I went back to what scholars refer to as the lynching era, I think 1880 to 1920, and started researching how scholars were dealing with it. And many people, you know, Amy Louise Woods, the theologian James Cone, and others talk about how scholars in that era did political and rhetorical work to make lynching take its symbolic significance, right? So we encounter it and we think, well, it's just always been this like really powerful symbol. But what I wanted to uncover was the political work that people had done, artists, writers, thinkers, theologians, preachers had done to sort of make lynching into something very important politically for Black
musicians.
People. Musician, right? Like a strange fruit,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so this, but Du Bois, W.B. Du Bois, James Cone, the theologian, says that he is the best among all the group of scholars who do the work of sort of making lynching politically important to Black people and making it helping it to serve as a kind of unifying political symbol in the fight against racial oppression. And he said, Edward Blum and others say that one of the ways that he was able to do this is by tying lynching to the biblical crucifixion, which then turns the lynched Black man into a martyr to racial oppression. Mm-hmm. So Du Bois wrote several stories that brought a Black or colored Jesus to the Jim Crow South. He sort of cast his lot with Black people, as Jesus would cast his lot with the downtrodden and the oppressed, right? And I think is a pretty good theological interpretation. And then for doing so, he's either crucified or lynched. And Edward Bloom, a scholar of these stories, these martyr tales that Du Bois wrote, says that, but it's important to note that Du Bois's Black Jesus, he lynched him again and again, but he very rarely resurrected him. And he did that for a very important point. He wanted to make a political point with it. He wanted Black people, right? So he wanted to compare, right, and think about Black people as martyrs to the American democratic experiment, which sort of raised their status in the democracy. But he also wanted to point out that the solution to racial oppression wasn't going to be a supernatural, right? That Black people were going to have to work to do it, that no Black Jesus was coming to save them. They were going to have to save themselves. So they could be like Jesus and follow his example, but there was going to be no magic solution to the problem.
Okay.
So that's that. All right. So Toni Morrison. So people have, including me, I'm a longtime critic of W.B. Du Bois about his sexism. So there are many, many things about him that can be critiqued, but like importantly, scholars like Sadia Hartman and others have critiqued his understanding of racial democracy. And so in Black Reconstruction, they say that he doesn't sort of pay attention to the sexual and reproductive violence that's is constitutive of Black women's labor in the period of enslavement. So that part of the work that they did was around sexual assault, bearing children, and rape, right? That those things were very important. And therefore, in a reformed democracy, you would have to figure out you would have to figure out political means of dealing with it. So Sadia Hartman says, all he offers Black women are marriage and children, and that's not enough to repair what happened, right? And so what I propose is that Du Bois is concerned with lynching, but if you look at Toni Morrison's books, she is very much concerned with the forms of intimate and reproductive violence that is central to the constitutive and foundational to the problem of femicide. So The Bluest Eye is about a tale of incest. Beloved is about infanticide after sexual assault. Jazz is about a woman killed because she has had sex. Paradise is about women killed because they are women. That is femicide. And Home is about a woman who's sterilized by a eugenicist doctor, right? So she is completely focused. If he is focused on lynching, she is very much focused on the forms of political, of violence that this intimate violence has been very important to what has happened to Black women historically and the sort of violence that's key to femicide.
Okay.
So that's how I make the move from so public violence in Du Bois, private violence in Toni Morrison.
Toni Morrison. Okay. You're listening to Writers' Voices. Our guest today is Shatima Threadcraft. The book we're talking about is The Labors of Resurrection, Black Woman, Necromancy, and Morrisonian Democracy. What is Morrisonian democracy?
Yes. So thank you for that question. So I juxtapose in Morrisonian democracy to Du Bois's abolition democracy. And Du Bois's abolition democracy is about a situation in which Black people have the land, education, and other resources they need to participate as equals, right? Following the problem of it not dealing with sexual and reproductive violence, I say that Morrisonian democracy is a feminist correction to his understanding of democracy. And in it, primarily through interpreting her novel Paradise, I call it a truant democracy, where women steal away from patriarchal systems to take time to repair themselves from the forms of sexual and reproductive violence that they face. And I specifically, truancy is important because not only do you see it happening in Paradise, but scholars of female enslavement, pioneering scholars like Deborah Gray White and Stephanie Camp have talked about truancy, that is taking brief absences from the period of enslavement as a particularly gendered form of resistance. So the most likely runaway slave was a male 18 years old, right? So he's just into adulthood, but he's not encumbered by family ties. he might, because of the ways in which divisions of labor on plantations where men would be drivers, but women would be much more tied to the home, right? And a concern for familial ties, right? So Deborah Gray White, I think, puts it in truancy, that is, taking brief absences away is how women balance their desire to leave with their need to stay. And so Stephanie Camp talks about truancy as a gendered form of resistance to slavery, where women would take away these brief absences, heal, rest, right? And she talks about how in doing so, they platted, she says, arrival geography into the plantation system that was ready to go once that system fell. So what I'm doing, part of what I'm doing is talking about both Black feminist literature and Black feminist history to think about Black feminist politics and the things that they've said. And so in Paradise, you know, the novel takes place with an all-Black town in Oklahoma. And it is sort of free of white violence because there are no white people. But in it, women face forms of patriarchy that they are only able to manage by visiting a convent, 17 miles away. So they take brief absences from their patriarchal lives, go to the convent and heal and go back. Right. And so therefore, my argument in the book is that Morrisonian democracy is concerned with repairing sexual and reproductive violence. It's concerned with that. It's groups of women who come together for brief moments to heal and then return to the patriarchal order from which they're from which they left. So it's about stealing a way to heal and then going back, but healing together.
Now, another word in the title is labor, the labors of resurrection. Yeah. And yeah. What do you mean by that? What are the labors of resurrection?
Yeah, so I one of the things that I wanted to do was in graduate school, I did a lot of work on Hannah Arendt, and she makes a distinction between the primary human activities that she named labor, work, and action. So labor is about care for human biological life, and typically is the work that women do. And work she saw as kind of the Marxian object-producing labor, like factory, very masculine labor. And then action is like politics, I think, effectively. So what I wanted to do is, there's a line in Edward Bloom that says, Du Bois left the work of resurrection to Black people here on earth. And so what I wanted to do by making it feminine labor is to point out that it's a project of care. It's a feminine project. I mean, there's the point that, you know, when you clean your house, you wash the dishes and you have to get up and wash the dishes again, right? It's unending. It doesn't stop, right? You make a table, the table's made. You clean your house, you have to clean your house tomorrow, right? Mm-hmm. But I want to point out that it is unceasing and largely feminine work, the work of caring for people who have passed on and to care for the people who are here, right? So the women that I profile, including Clementine Barfield, you know, I want to point out that they continue to care for their children who have passed on, right? And so, but one of the things that a big point that I want to make in the book is that Du Bois and Morrison have different ways of understanding the political place of the dead. And I want to say that, or I want to point out the distinction that Du Bois left his Jesus dead, but Morrison brings the dead back all the time. So dead characters always, right? So the dead stay in Morrison, right? And I think in many ways, these women who I profile also figure out ways to politically represent the dead, right? So either they figure out a way, but that we can't progress as a society if we are not attentive to the voices of the dead. And that is important for Morrison and important in different ways for all of the women I profile. So that Du Bois thinks the dead have to go and that magic has nothing to do with democracy. The maybe far too cute point I want to make, right, is that Du Bois leaves his Jesus dead, and these women think that you have to bring the dead back. I think there's also an important point between moral blamelessness and not, right? So that I want to point out that it's not women that are perfect that are being resurrected, like Jesus, right? Everyone, women who have had, say, sexual past that might be, morally blameworthy, according to some, it's not that you have to die perfect to come back, and that we need you here.
So I think one of the examples that you write about of women resurrecting the dead and it being for, I mean, it having a huge impact on the political situation was Emmett Till's mother. Do you want to, not everyone might know, you know, we're pretty far that happened, what, over
a long time, 1955.
Maybe not everyone who's listening to this is even familiar with the story. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
I can. So Emmett Till was murdered in Money, Mississippi when he was visiting his family there. He was a young boy from Chicago and was visiting his mother's relatives in Mississippi. The story is that he, you know, the pretext for murdering him was his supposed sexual advance at a white woman, for which her husband and brother-in-law, I think, I'm not sure about that part, doesn't matter, I don't pay attention to murderers, killed Till. His mother, his body was brought back to Chicago, and famously his mother made the decision that the world needed to see his body. So many people attended his funeral, but more importantly, Jet magazine circulated pictures of his body. And it has been called the most important sort of political use of a dead body in the 20th century. But the photos were very important in strengthening Black young Black people's resolve to join the civil rights movement. Others, what I want to point out in the book is that Christopher Mitras talks about the incarnations of Emmett Till and the ways in which politically we have, Black people have reincarnated Emmett Till in many ways, right? So again, a work of resurrection, the poet, right? To bring him back to speak and have a voice in our politics, right? And so he is resurrected, you know, as blameless, as a child, as angry, right? In many, many different forms. He has many, many different affects to serve the political purpose of the people that need him, right? But that, you know, I named the chapter Emmett Till is with us still, like he never left, right? And so we have to think about that as political practice.
Shatima, why don't you read a little bit from The Labors of Resurrection for us?
Yes, so I thought that I should read the opening chapter a bit from the introduction, if that's okay. All right. Okay, so beginning in the 1970s, serial killers and serial murders targeted and terrorized Black women in American cities, including Atlanta, Boston, Detroit, Los Angeles, Newark, Pittsburgh, Pensacola, Portland, Oakland, San Diego, Seattle, Rochester, and Washington, D.C., while largely escaping the notice of the wider public. The Atlanta murders are a particularly interesting case. So while the city was in a panic about the Black cultural touchstone that would become known as the Atlanta Child Murders, which involved the serial killing of 26 Black, mostly male children, teens, and young adults, police also discovered the bodies of 34 Black women and girls, as well as 4 white women. Now, these latter deaths received nowhere near the level of community, police, and media attention devoted to the former cases. But while the larger community may not have registered Black women, these Black women and girls' deaths as acutely, the murderers of this era spawned coast-to-coast Black feminist mobilization. So 2 years after the Combahee River Collective released its iconic Black feminist statement, for example, members of the collective were mobilized in response to the murder of 6 Black women in Boston in 1960. Founding Combahee River member Barbara Smith would later provide an account of the context for this mobilization. She would say, the first story about the murders appeared on the page of the Boston Globe, where the racing results were, in other words, buried in the back of the newspaper. People in the Black community in Boston were up in arms. You have to understand, we'd gone through the horrors of the school desegregation crisis in 1974, and in the mid-1970s, we were constantly dealing with police brutality. There were all kinds of things going on, outright racial hate activity. There was a high school football player who was shot on the football field in Charlestown just for playing football. He was permanently paralyzed. So we had been through a lot in Boston. So when the murders of Black women started to happen a few years later, they were immediately understood as racial crimes, but it was only Black women who were being murdered. Now, Smith characterized the media and police response to the murders, to these killings, as typically racist. So not only did the Boston Globe allot the murdered Black women column space adjacent to the horse racing results, but other members of the press thought that they did not rate even this level of attention. So a white male journalist from the New York Times declined to attend a press conference after the death of a 12th woman, Smith remembered, because it was, quote, not news. He told her that he could call any city in the country and get that statistic. Now, the Boston Police Department, for its part, pushed back against the idea of a serial killer, arguing that the Black women were being terrorized individually, not serially, and by members of their own community, and apparently that was just. Now, Combahee River Collective members attended an April 1st rally held by Crisis, a Black female-led grassroots organization that mobilized in response to the murders. And on that day, a crowd of 1,500 took to the streets to mourn the loss of their sisters, daughters, mothers, and friends. The march began at the Harriet Tubman House in Boston's South End and passed by the Wellington Street apartment of the victim, Daryl Ann Hargett, who was found strangled on the floor of her bedroom. Hargett's aunt, Sarah Small, addressed the crowd and asked, who is killing us, right? So later in the march, as Smith stood in a field next to the Stride-Rite factory, which was significant because the remains of two of the victims had been found wrapped in a plastic, in a garbage bag next to the factory. But she listened to the march's primarily male speakers advise completely unrealistic stuff. They were saying things like, we need to protect our women and women need to stay inside the house. Nothing about sexual politics or sexual violence. It was all about racial crimes. Well, why was it only women who were being murdered if the only reason they were being murdered was because of race? So their analysis infuriated her, and she went home and she was just steaming. And that day she would write a draft of the pamphlet, Six Black Women, Why Did They Die? So she called a few members of the collective and they told her that it was good, right? So, but in the pamphlet, Smith explicitly made the connection that the male speakers at the rally had missed or ignored, linking the deaths of Boston's Black women to pervasive violence against women, to sexual assault and sexual harassment and intimate partner violence. She said, what has happened in Boston's Black community is a thread in the fabric of all of the violence, is a thread in the fabric of violence against women. Its purpose to instill fear and powerlessness and cause women to internalize their second class status in society. She explicitly rejected the notion that it was men's duty to protect women from other men. And because this reinforced the belief that women were weak, helpless, and independent, she said that Black women had to learn to protect themselves by learning common sense safety measures and self-defense, setting up phone chains, etc. Now, Smith's pamphlet was a blockbuster success. The collective originally printed 2,000 copies, but demand was so great that they eventually distributed as many as 30,000 copies, including a Spanish translation. She would say in the pamphlet that it's true that the victims were all Black and that Black people have always been the targets of racist violence in this society, but they were also all women. Our sisters died because they were women just as surely as they died because they were Black. So Smith then identified the murders as Black women. So I go on to give statistics about Black women. I give a definition of Black femicide, which I gave early on in the podcast, so I won't give it again. And then I say that this continues. So should I keep reading this or that's it?
That's good. I think that's a good place to stop. So thank you. That was Shatima Threadcraft reading from The Labors of Resurrection from the introduction. So you mentioned in that reading, the idea of women needing to defend themselves, and you have a whole section in here, which I found really interesting, about gun defense.
Yes.
So that is that there is a movement to arm Black women for self-defense, or all women, really.
Yeah. No, I mean, and it was, when I found this, it was interesting, right? Because it's, you know, some of this is about data, some of this is about information. One of the women, I think Marshall Tig Davis, is the woman who created a database of Black women who, of like companies that will train Black women in arms management. But her goal, so she is a survivor of intimate partner violence. She's a veteran, and her goal is to train 1 million Black women to defend themselves. So she has these retreats, right? They include brunch and other self-care, but also you go out to a gun range. Yeah.
I think so, I mean, that actually sounded like fun.
I know. It's really, you know, and she does like tire maintenance, like how to change a tire, how to get a go bag. I think it's very, yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting because, right, in one sense, you could have a kind of, this is very individualistic. This is sort of not a solution. And I think with the ways in which women are now punished for killing abusive partners, right, this is maybe not the solution, but it could be the only solution you have if it's your life or theirs, right?
Right.
And yes, that they do it in community so that you could do it with other women and sort of have brunch and understand that other women are doing this too, right?
Right.
The other woman that I found through the database is a doula who trains in arms as part of pregnancy care and as birth work, right? Because pregnancy is such a dangerous time in a woman's life, that part of the work of getting ready, part of the work of being pregnant is figuring out how to defend yourself should your partner not want that to be what's going on.
That is scary to think about.
It's terrifying.
I never occurred to me that that is a risky time for women.
Well, it's so the idea is that the men are typically are killed during the commission of other felonies, but women are generally killed during the course of an argument when no other felony is going on. So that they are killed over changing the status of a relationship. So when they are trying to leave the relationship and no longer be in it, or they're trying to move from partners to parents, right? And so trying to make a change, and I think a unilateral change potentially in the relationship, it puts you at risk. And pregnancy is the big one.
Wow.
But leaving is the other big one.
And then, of course, the maternal deaths that aren't from violence, but from lack of adequate care,
yes,
are also an issue.
Yes. So the UN model protocol for the investigation, Latin American model protocol for the investigation of gender-related killing, defines active and passive femicide. So active is intentional killings, but passive are these deaths of neglect where botched abortions, right, abortion access and pregnancy and childbirth related deaths are part of this, right? So Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die during pregnancy, childbirth, and in the postpartum period than white women. This is something that has been sort of for the past, since about 2018, when there was a big article in the New York Times, this has been sort of an issue for people. But part of what I want to talk about is that this is a part of this wider femicide crisis, and that you are sort of at risk of murder by your partner. But there was a meme going around that doctors are to Black women what police are to Black men, right? So of course, not all police kill Black men and not all doctors kill Black women, but that it is a dangerous time. And that medical neglect, right, a healthcare system not designed around the needs of Black women's bodies, right, and thinking with epigenetics and this long history of reproductive violence that I've been talking about, that forms of healthcare, they'll need more healthcare and different healthcare to have equalized the birth outcomes, right, is a part of it. So that But I think that the happy story there, if there's one to tell, right, is that that's where we should focus our intervention. So we have criminalized Black women not going, any woman not going to the doctor. So Jennifer Morgan writes about the free birth movement and people who try to have birth outside of any medical system, because if something happens, you're charged with neglect, right? So you have to go to the doctor. We have made it such that, right, like men, forget men. They never have to go to the doctor. This is why public health is always chasing them, because they haven't been screened. We don't know all their problems. You got to put them in a car, strap them in, and knock them out and get them to the doctor. But women are socialized to have to go to the doctor often because of pregnancy. You have to go, right? But that means that that is a key point of contact, and we know where they are, right? And so we need to give them sort of anti-violence resources at that point, right? We can figure, right, that we can build an entire infrastructure around that, because that is at such a risky point for them, right? So that's the kind of good news of the story.
So, Shatima, you talked about how different chapters of the book might appeal to different readers. And I just sort of wanted to go through the chapters and kind of give the elevator pitch for each chapter.
Okay, yeah, huh, that's a new one.
All
Huh, I gotta think about that. All right.
right. All right. So chapter one is Necropolitics and Vision. So
Yes.
what is that chapter about?
Yeah, that's a play on Sheldon Wolin's piece, Politics and Vision. That's how I named his book. But it's about sort of trying to define what specifically necropolitics is. So the politics of death, right? And what they are for Black women, and sort of mapping out the different ways in which Black women face the threat of death than Black men,
And
right?
there
So
you
it's
talk about the passive femicide that we just discussed.
yeah,
And yes, okay.
and all of those things. But Isshiel Mbembe sort of came up with the concept of necropolitics as a corrective to Michel Foucault's biopolitics, where he's so Michel Foucault says the modern state is all about extending life, and Mbembe says, well, you're not looking in the right places, because it's a lot of death too. Right. And so part of, but he doesn't sort of talk about gender. And part of what I'm trying to do is kind of map out the specific forms of premature death that haunt Black women.
Okay, chapter two, Taming the Lady Leviathan, Tending the Grassroots, Black Women Confront Black Femicide. All right, first of all, what is Lady Leviathan?
Okay, so Leviathan is referring to a book by Thomas Hobbes, and it's about the state that's going to sort of take care, the modern state that's going to look after our needs. But part of this is talking about the ways in which a criminalization approach to violence against women has not helped Black women, right? So the Lady Leviathan would be the ways in which feminists sort of partner with the state, so giving the that state a feminine face, right? And so thinking about bringing police into the issue, like making violence against women a state concern when it hadn't been 50 years ago, and what that has done for Black women, right? So giving the state some feminist directives, and me saying it didn't go that well. Not me, people before me, but yeah.
That it didn't go that well. Is there hope for that? Is it, can we do better?
Think so. I think you probably don't need to give the power to people with guns, but the state does things without people that don't have guns work for the state all the time.
Yes,
So
that is true.
potentially, yeah.
Okay. And some of and that's where we talk about the armed self-defense movement in
Yeah, so I
there
go
and
through, yeah, so people that tried police and media reform, sort of data activism, so trying to deal with the Chicago PD and like the struggle to get better records, right? Better record keeping around the murder, armed self-defense, and then sort of community-based mutual aid solutions. Yeah, so the armed self-defense versus a more pacifist type response to it.
Okay. Chapter three, I think we've covered this pretty well, the democratic
Boy,
storytelling
yeah.
of W.E.B. Du Bois. How do you pronounce
So
Du
Du Bois,
Bois?
has
Du
a
Bois.
French, you
Okay.
know, a Haitian or French ancestor, but it is always, so it is a French name that has always been pronounced in English the
Oh,
same.
okay.
So you're pronouncing it correct in French, but
French.
it's pronounced in English with an S.
Okay, gotcha. And where he where his stories talk about lynching and relating that to crucifixion, and we talked about how he doesn't resurrect Jesus.
That's right.
Okay. And then we haven't really talked so much about Ida B. Wells.
Well,
Yeah, which
yes.
is chapter 4, Princess, Prophet, Miracle Worker, Ida B. Wells and the Empirical Miracle or Variations on the Black We.
Yeah, there's a lot.
Okay, there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, so this is about Ida B. Wells and trying to complicate her. So she's sort of well known for innovating a social scientific approach to lynching. She uses data about, so she famously takes, she only looks at white newspapers and looks at the reasons given for lynching. And from that data comes up with the fact that it's not about sexual violence. It's not even, white people themselves don't even say it's about black men raping white women. Right. And so she says this is about economic conflict. And that becomes like using data in against premature black death. But I sort of go, you know, and that's one thing, and that's a fairly old story about her, but important in as a political grandmother to the women who are using data today. But I am taught, but I, you know, mainly talk about, or one of the things that I really like talking about with her. I say, like her biographer Paula Geddings says, that she sort of innovates this concept of saying their names and not say, you know, don't say the name of the murderer, say the name of the person murdered. But also the ways in which she trolled Edward Carmack, the racist white journalist who was responsible for the destruction of her newspaper that exiled her. So when she wrote about her friends being lynched, this very racist white newspaper editor, also in the town of Memphis, sort of was responsible for getting her paper destroyed. And so she left for New York and England and other places. But part of what she would do is write things, and she would mail them to him to make him mad, mocking his tone and other things. So I say that she was like an internet troll before the internet. So it's right. I mean,
Okay, okay. You know, when you're talking about that, it makes me think of Gavin Newsom.
Yes, right. So that, right, like the sincerity, just the point that is sincerity is not the always the best way to tell the truth. Sometimes you have to tell the truth by making fun of people.
Okay, and then the next chapter we did talk about too, Emmett Till is with us still. And then the sixth chapter is Seeding Restorative Kinship, Clementine Barfield and So Sad's Otherworldly Democratic Horticulture.
I know my titles are really long, but this is about Save Our Sons and Daughters. So Sad is a Detroit-based youth organization that Clementine Barfield started after her son Derek was murdered in an act of youth violence. And I think that she was really my parent, and Melinda Price, who I quote a lot in this, she's like my paradigm case where she helped me understand that this resurrection was a thing that was happening. And she sort of repeatedly talked about her son and talk and had conver and talks about herself as having conversations with her son. Members of So Sad would hold birthday parties for their murdered children. So they would be in a practice of, as Price understands it, continuing to parent their dead children as they work with living children. And the horticulture part is that they understood children symbolically as trees, that they needed to be planted in the correct soil, be rooted, and to grow. And part of their practice of caring for dead children involved helping living children plant trees, and the children were symbolized in the trees, and you tended the trees. So tending your dead, right? Kids need, right? So that the symbolism is all tied up in the horticulture, right? Like, so that it's a practice of making the right. So showing respect, honoring, and keeping the dead present through a practice that is concretely changing the physical environment that we are living in.
Okay. Chapter 7. Revivifying ephemeral yeah. Publix, yeah. Margaret Prescott and the Black Coalition Fighting Back Serial Killers.
Yeah, so all of these, I mean, you know, Ida B. Wells is like the original badass woman, but Margaret Prescott, Barbara Smith, all of these women are great. But Barbara Smith sort of co-founds Black Women for Wages for Housework in New York in the 1970s, but moves to, because of her husband's job, moves to Los Angeles in the 80s, just in time for the announcement of a serial killer of Black women in Los Angeles.
This is Margaret Prescott?
Prescott. Okay. Yeah, sorry, Margaret Prescott. And yeah. So She has been working with sex worker organizing. She has been doing a lot of stuff around organizing around welfare rights, right? But non-traditional women in non-traditional family formations and sexual relationships, and organizing around them. And the police originally, when they finally kind of start talking about these murders, because they belatedly sort of link them together, then when they start talking about them, they're like prostitute slaves, right? Already as a way to sort of blame women for getting themselves killed. And so, but because she's been in working with sex workers for decades and knows police antagonism around sex workers and knows what's going on here, right, really is perfectly positioned to come in and give a critique, right? And so she starts fighting with Daryl Gates sort of 7 years before he's going to go down in Rodney King and O.J. Simpson and these other things. But he is like very, he's really nasty to her. She doesn't care. she dealt with men like that all the time. It's not a problem for her. But really, right. a great organization of sex workers, of a union of sex workers and other sort of welfare mothers and others who come together and organize against the serial murders of Black women.
And then chapter 8 is the Toni Morrison, focus on Toni Morrison, which we've talked about. And before we run out of time, we didn't really address this, the true crime.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the focus on true crime and how that impacts these issues.
Yeah. So I really am influenced by Terrion Williamson's work, who works on serial murder of Black women. And she talks about how true crime really works to bring us into the subject position of the murderer. So we want to see how he thinks and the women are bodies, right? They're in the ways that they're in the narrative because of the violence. And it is the violence that makes them relevant. And they are, when they are on the ground and murdered, they are literally objects and he is the subject. So you are humanizing the serial killer by trying to get into his point of view while women are rendered motionless and just objects for our fascination.
Okay, so, you know, true crime has a lot of fans.
It does. I mean, yeah.
I don't tend to go for that. Although I love reading crime fiction, but not true crime.
Yeah, I mean, I love a lady detective story.
Yeah,
I confess that.
Yeah. So what would be better? What would be a better way
to bring
attention to these murders?
Yeah, the femicide activists and the people who are doing it the right way, I think, are the people who are trying to highlight and elevate the lives of the women who die, right? That anytime someone tells you the name of a murderer, you should repeat loudly the names of his victims, because he doesn't deserve to have his name.
Yeah.
She does, right? And so say her name, I think, right? So, you know,
Yeah.
Let me leave it there.
Okay. All right. So we're almost out of time, but
yeah.
So you're working in an area that's come under a lot of fire recently.
Yeah, I am.
How do you deal with that?
Well, you know, my students, I think, are hungry for these things. And I teach, you know, I think kids want to know, and we have to be happy when kids want to know. You know, I would challenge people to make the pro side of murdering women, right? Like, I don't think that there's another, right? So
yeah,
if you want
yeah.
to come at me to teach why we should kill women, go ahead. You know, like, I don't see two sides of this issue.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, yes. I want to thank you for being with us today, Shatima. And
well, thank you so much for having me. This is great.
It's a very, very interesting and topic that I wish we didn't have to write about.
Yeah.
Didn't have to study, but that's the way of the world, I guess.
Maybe one day.
We always close with the quote, and so of course I needed to pick one from Toni Morrison.
Never can go wrong.
And she said, the very serious function of racism is distraction. It keeps you from doing your work. It keeps you explaining over and over again your reason for being.
Amen. Yeah.
So thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices. Thank you.